From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. The debate over school choice is heating up here in Idaho. Earlier this week, the Senate Education Committee introduced a proposal to repeal our state's Blaine Amendment, which is a clause that bans public spending on religious schools. And last week, conservative Idaho legislators released language for a bill that would create education savings accounts, basically allowing parents to use public money for private school tuition. So bottom line, what does all of this mean for taxpayers, for parents, for students, not to mention how this could potentially impact schools, both urban and rural? So joining us today to talk more in depth about this are Kevin Richer, senior reporter with Idaho Education News, Terry Ryan, CEO of Bloom, and Will Overgaard, retired superintendent of the Weiser School District. I want to welcome all of you to the program today.
Hi, Gemma.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So, Kevin, I want to start with you, and let's set the scene here, because the idea of school choice, it's not new. And basically the idea is let the money follow the child. So can you tell us how this issue has heated up in the State House? Also, where are we currently in terms of what we could see happen at the legislature this session?
Well, I think where we are right now is you're seeing positioning and jockeying at the State House about that very question of what is school choice? What are we doing right now? And do we need to do more? I was in the House Education Committee today, and the State Department of Education did a presentation about what is already available in terms of school choice. When you talk about charter schools, when you talk about virtual charter schools, homeschooling, private schools that are in existence right now, with or without any kind of financial backing through state dollars. Basically saying that we have all of these options right now. And that's kind of consistent with what we've heard from Governor Little, who has suggested that, we're doing quite a bit right now and, questioning whether more needs to be done. Folks on the other side of the debate are saying that that's not enough, that doesn't go far enough. And, that's why they're pushing for an education savings account bill or something along those lines that would do something we don't do right now, which would allow public dollars to flow into private education, to flow into the tuition costs of private education. That's the question. Do we want to go down that road? Because right now, that's not something we do.
So, Terry, let me bring you into the conversation very quickly for folks who are not familiar with Bloom. Can you tell us what your organization is? And then I would really like to hear your thoughts on why you believe that this issue of school choice has taken center stage.
Sure. So my organization primarily has been about providing resources to grow Idaho's public charter school sector. And so over the last year, the last decade, we've helped to double the charter school sector in terms of its size. And as Kevin notes, this is public school choice. It's a fairly well-developed mechanism now. However, I have to note, when it was first proposed 25 years ago, there was a lot of angst about what public charter schools would do to traditional districts and fear that it would bring down districts or cost them so much money districts would have to cut back and that sort of thing. That hasn't happened. In terms of the national conversation, I think Kevin touched on this, but it's smart red state politics now to be talking about moving towards, let's call it, universal school choice. We're seeing it in all the red states, really. Utah, Iowa are two states that just this session in their states, they've passed legislation to move towards more school choice, specifically dollars following students to religious private schools. There are a lot of practical issues associated with that. There's mm-hmm. the ideological, philosophical arguments. It gets hard to do in practice, as has been growing charter schools in our state. Could talk more about that. But I think there's just a lot of political momentum, certainly in red states, around this issue. And I think it stems in part from the frustration that a lot of people perceive that happened during the pandemic and school closure and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, Will, you were an educator for more than 40 years here in Idaho in rural and urban districts. You were a teacher. You moved all the way up to being a superintendent. You also spent time teaching in the private sector. So you have basically done it all. I am curious as to your thoughts on school choice and how that would impact the average student.
Well, Gemma, I think, you know, Superintendent Critchfield and Governor Little have done a nice job of outlining the extent that school choice has grown and developed in the state over time. And it's really quite extensive, and it continues to grow. And but what happens with the advent of universal education savings account is that unlike the Constitution, which requires the legislature, it mandates that they create and maintain a general uniform throw system framework for delivering education. This movement to giving every parent a voucher for a certain amount of money and then letting them choose has a potential for damaging your rural neighborhood public schools who there aren't those options. There's options in most rural public schools for many of the choice options that were outlined by the superintendent and the governor. And we've even seen some growth in the charter school movement into the rural areas. But to take that per pupil dollar and say every parent of the 320,000 public school students, the 15 or so thousand private school students, and any number, we don't know the number because they aren't registered with the state, of homeschool students, and say, here's $6,000 for you to spend anyway. You know, there are some guidelines, but it's pretty much a free for all in terms of how they use those dollars. So that has the potential to undermine and really set rural neighborhood schools behind the eight ball.
So, Kevin, let's talk money for a moment, because do we know yet if we were to go to this voucher system, what every family would get potentially per child? And as Will just mentioned, I mean, we don't know how many homeschool children there are. So how then do we make sure there's enough money in the pot to go around?
And I think that's going to be one of the big questions as this debate really heats up at the State House is, you know, how much money are we talking about? The Education Savings Account bill that was introduced on Tuesday in the Senate Education Committee, and that's just an introductory hearing. You don't get down into the nitty-gritty details of a bill at that point. It just simply gets the bill out. So what we know about the bill at this point is that I think the spending in the bill is capped at $20 million. But critics of an Education Savings Account program who are going to look at what's happened in Arizona are going to say, well, you know, hold on to your hats. The cost goes up considerably over time. You know, that $20 million at the outset here, that may just be the beginning of what it might cost. That's going to be a key point in the debate. How much money are we really talking about here?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, go ahead.
This is Will. You know, I looked for a fiscal note. And I didn't see, I had heard that number of 20 million, you know, thrown about. But in reading the bill, the proposed legislation, I didn't see anything that limited the number of applications they were going to accept. And those applications don't set income limits. So it's wide open. Anybody can apply. And 20 million would fund at the proposed just under $6,000, about 3,300 students, but there's 15,000 private school students, and we don't know how many public school students might try and move to a private school, and we don't know how many homeschool students might try and so the potential is way more than 20 million. And what has happened in all the states that have enacted ESA programs over time is it grows and grows and grows every year. And so what that does is, as more money flows into those what hadn't been funded before by public education into these ESA accounts used at private schools, that's got to have an impact on the amount of funds available to public schools, neighborhood schools, especially in rural areas where you have don't have kids attending private schools.
Can I jump in on this, Gemma?
Absolutely, Terry.
So that was the argument that was made against charter schools 25 years ago, that basically they're going to drain the traditional schools of money and it's going to come at the expense of the traditional schools. The fact of the matter is, it's not a zero-sum game because Idaho's been growing. It's been adding families. It's been adding students. So it's also been seeing its budget for K-12 education go up. And so the idea that this is going to be the death of traditional schools, I think, goes too far. I do agree that there needs to be a strategic or thoughtful approach to this. The idea that you're just going to open the doors up and make Idaho like Arizona, I think would be a huge mistake. I think that what we've learned from the charter school experience is that this is a thing that should go and be worked on year in and year out as you create more opportunities for families and their children. I mean, our economy is changing. The way we deliver instruction is changing. And I do think that there also needs to be some sort of, let's call it public assurance of quality. In the language that I saw come out last week, it was, and I think it was Will who said, a free-for-all. The idea that you're just going to give money to parents and they're going to do whatever they want to do with it, I think that goes too far. I think there needs to be public assurances attached to that money that you're actually delivering educational opportunities that help our students actually learn, be it in English language arts or mathematics. So this idea of kind of the philosophical debate that it's either it's a free for all or it's the death of democracy and education in our state, I think goes too far on both sides. And there's an opportunity here as we grow to create more opportunities for families and our children and to do it in a way where we're aware of what's working and what's not. And the state would have an important role in that. And it's a smart, slow go approach, I think, for Idaho's how we've done things. That's kind of been the history of the charter school program here. And I think other reforms, and I think there's a lot of merit in that. This is evolutionary, not revolutionary.
Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Very, very quick, Gemma. A very quick point about the funding and how much this would cost. You got to remember that whatever the education committees come up with and whatever may pass on the policy end, you still have to fund that, and that gets funded through the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. It'll be up to those budget writers. Ultimately, they would decide how much or how little to put into a program like this.
And Kevin, my understanding really quick is that these 15,000 plus students who are in private schools right now, I mean, there is no money following those students. So wouldn't we have to come up with that money?
Well, that's the point. I mean, we haven't been doing this yet, and this kind of bill would do that for the first time. So, yeah, the question is how many parents would want to take advantage of this? Parents who have kids already in the private schools, in addition to any parents who are saying, well, now I would like to take a look at private schools. So, to Will's point, it's really hard to start to figure out how much this might cost.
It's important we need to determine who should be eligible.
I want to take this last part of the conversation and really dig in to private school choice versus other choices. So, Terry, first off, what is private school choice and how is it different from something like public charter school choice?
So private school choice, as it's being described in the bill you referenced, would be allowing money to follow children, public dollars, public tax dollars, following children to private schools, be they religious, be they parochial. And that would be a big difference. Right now, public dollars do not follow Idaho students to a private school. So public charter schools, on the other hand, are schools that have more freedoms and flexibility than traditional district schools have. They operate under an agreement, what's known as an authorizer. In our state, that's mostly school districts and the Public Charter School Commission. And they have to follow many of the same rules as traditional district schools when it comes to issues of funding, special education. They have to have a lottery if they're over-enrolled. They have to take state assessments. And frankly, they're held to a higher standard because they have a performance certificate that every year, in the case of the Public Charter School Commission, they release a report on how the schools are doing on their agreed-to metrics of performance. And so they are public schools. They enroll all kids. They provide special education, and they have some flexibilities around governance, around some use of money, but not a lot, and certainly some flexibilities around who they can hire as teachers and who they can hire to actually be the school leaders. So that I think I answered your question. I hope I did.
Yeah, you did. So, Will, let's talk about school choice in regards to private schools in rural school districts, because 20 Idaho counties don't have private schools, period. So that option is off the table. As you mentioned, there are some rural school districts that are getting more school choice in regards to charter schools. Are you concerned at all then about taxpayer money, especially if you live in a rural county that does not have an option for private school, and we go down this path of ESAs, and all of a sudden, taxpayer money is literally being funneled out of rural areas because they don't have that private school option?
Well, Gemma, yeah, let me say that about beyond the 20 counties that don't have a private school, you have in the other counties that do, there's a list of 118 private schools on the State Department website that somehow they've accumulated that list. 85 of those schools are in just seven counties. So Ada County has 34, Kootenai County 13, Canyon 10, Twin Falls 9, and then there's a number that only counties that only have one. So if I think you could make the argument that going down this new road, you'd be asking Idahoans, taxpayers across the state to subsidize these private schools in areas that they don't draw benefit from or their kids couldn't attend. And it's pretty significant. And you also know that, you know, Idaho being we trade places with Utah being the last in the country in terms of per pupil expenditures. And school districts are tax themselves. They go to their boards, go to their patrons and say, hey, we'd like to have a supplemental levy. And they're very successful in Idaho over the last decade. About 93% of these supplemental levies have been passed. And that accounts, so there's 89 schools, there's $217 million out there that are supplement the state appropriation. If rural schools, their income from the public schools funds become stagnant or is even reduced, there'll be more pressure for districts to have to go back to their patrons and ask for supplemental levies, which, you know, there is that general sense. I think the Boise Public BSU survey said when you ask people about the state of education, they generally think it's not in good shape. But if you ask them about their local schools, well, they think their local schools are okay. Mm-hmm. So because they know those teachers, they know they go to school with, they go to church with them, they shop with them. So they have more favorable attitudes towards their public schools, and they're willing to help and fund them. I don't know if rural taxpayers would be interested in having a portion of their sales tax and their income taxes go to these private schools. That's a question. Mm-hmm.
So, Kevin, then I mentioned the Blaine Amendment at the beginning of the program. This is basically our state constitution saying you cannot give public money to private schools. Mm-hmm. Why is this part being challenged constitutionally?
Well, I think you've had a lot of push towards looking at the Blaine Amendment and trying to repeal the Blaine Amendment in light of at least a pair of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that have called into question the constitutionality of such amendments. I think I will be really curious to see how far a push to repeal the Blaine Amendment goes in the State House. You know, it's difficult to amend the Constitution. You have to pass a constitutional amendment by a two-thirds threshold in both the Senate and the House, and then you have to get an amendment passed by a majority of voters. That's a pretty high hurdle in terms of trying to amend the Constitution. I'm not surprised that we're seeing a push in Senate education to try to repeal that amendment. I'm just not sure it's going to pass.
Mm-hmm. I only have about 3 minutes left. So, Terry, in your opinion, should private schools even be a part of this conversation? And I ask that question because private schools, as you mentioned about charter schools, right, you have special education teachers. You follow, you have to follow certain rules that the public school system has to follow. You are under the umbrella of public schools. Private schools don't have to have special education programs. They can pick and choose what students they want. And yet this idea then of we're going to give public money to that, I think that's a real sticking point for a lot of people.
Well, taxpayers should, if money is going to follow children to private schools, there should be public assurances attached to those dollars that the kids are in fact learning something, and that there's you could have accreditation, you could have nationally normed reference assessments. There's ways of getting at that. So I absolutely believe if you take public dollars, there should be strings attached. The second point I'd make real quick is to Kevin's point. I think if I was advising folks on challenging the Blaine Amendment, I wouldn't do the full frontal and try to get an amendment to the Constitution. What the Supreme Court has determined is that our Blaine Amendment is unconstitutional. So what you would want is to have a parent take these private dollars, go to a school, have the state say you can't use these dollars and have a lawsuit. That would be the best way to go about trying to challenge the Blaine Amendment in our state. That's what's happening in other states. And then I think the third thing to say is that supply and demand do matter here. I think it was Will that was getting at this. My experience is most people actually like the schools that their children attend. And we've seen that in the charter space. It's not like a lot of flood from, oh gosh, I'm going to flee my district school. Now there are people who are frustrated and they want other options, or they just need other options for their students. I think the public school sector in Idaho should stand up and say, you know what, we do a pretty good job. I know our charter schools feel that way, that we are the best choice. Now there's an issue of the level playing field here. This idea that you're going to give money and it's going to follow and there are no strings attached to it and you don't have any idea what the performance of the students are. I think if you're going to have choice and competition, and I think we've seen this with the charters and the traditional schools, is there's got to be something akin to a level playing field with a level way of getting at school performance. I think that needs to be part of the conversation. And frankly, those who are proponents of universal school choice in Idaho aren't dealing with those hard issues, those implementation issues that you'd have to deal with. I think need to be part of this conversation.
So, Terry, yes, go ahead, Will, real quick.
I just want to mention that in the proposed legislation, there is no required reporting of student outcomes. There's no required assessment.
That's a problem.
And there's actually, and if they accept the savings account, if they enroll and they are accepted, there's no required compulsory attendance like there are in the public schools. Mm. So those are issues. But I want to say one thing about the Supreme Court cases. And because Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the two most, the majority opinion in both the important recent cases, the Carson-Macon in Maine, the Espinoza case in Montana. And hear what he said. And he said the same thing in both cases. He said, a state need not subsidize private education.
I want to thank all of you for your time today. I know there is so much more that we could be talking about. Will, I apologize, you dropped out. So I would love to have you all back on later in the session to see where we come with this. But I so appreciate all of your time, for your expertise, for your knowledge on this issue. Thank you to Kevin Richard, senior reporter at Idaho Education News, Terry Ryan, CEO of Bloom, and Will Overgaard, retired superintendent of the Weiser School District. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.